Good morning. I'm Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM at the campus of Seton Hall University, located in South Orange, New Jersey. We're pleased to have back in our studio today Dr. Scott Parazynski, our NASA astronaut who's been to space five times and has actually climbed Mount Everest as well. And I must say he's the only human that we know of that has achieved both of these feats. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you, Darrell. Glad to be here.
And Scott, as we were talking about your preparation for your space flight, let's talk about some of the key leadership challenges that the leader faces on the flight.
In space flight, it's really quite unique. The commander really has to make decisions in a very stressful environment. The decisions that are made oftentimes are life and death. You're sitting on 7 million pounds of rocket propellant thrust, and so you really do have to have a lot of confidence in your team and know that know their strengths and weaknesses, and you oftentimes don't have the ability to dwell on data and make a deliberate slow decision. You have to act, and so that comes with a great deal of training, of course, and the development of trust between the members of the team.
And when you're up there in space and you have a particular sticky issue, how is the discussion conveyed amongst the group? How is it organized so that it stays very constructive and to the point of solving the problem and not pointing fingers?
I think that comes through the training process that I mentioned during the last discussion we had. We tend to go out as new crews using the National Outdoor Leadership School, and each crew then develops their own leadership style and the dynamics that make things work in a challenging environment. But you also become very close friends. There's a great deal of respect between members of a crew. And I've always found that the conversations tend to be very respectful, but also very focused. I would also point out that a fair number of the astronaut corps hail from the military, so there's a certain operating protocol that tends to become part of the culture of most crews, and so you stay very operationally focused, and also there's a great deal of coordination with mission control that's similarly focused. So, unless it's a time critical type of decision that needs to be made, we'll consult with the flight director down in Mission Control, Houston.
You know, I have to ask because John Glenn is a personal hero of mine, mm-hmm. being a young man growing up and reading about him circling, orbiting the Earth. You were actually on a mission with him where you were monitoring, his body's reaction to space, if you will. How was that mission, and how did you get to know Senator John Glenn quite closely?
I certainly did. It was thrill of a lifetime to fly with John. He was one of my boyhood heroes as well, and it still is a hero. You know, he's a hero to multiple generations because he's shown what people can do as senior citizens as well. You know, his mind is still as sharp as it is ever was, still extremely active. We flew STS-95 when he was 77 years old, incredibly fit guy, and had the opportunity to monitor a number of medical investigations that were looking at how a more senior astronaut adjusts to the microgravity of space versus the adaptations of a younger astronaut, because this microgravity of space is a great analog for the aging process. You may not be aware of this, but even a young astronaut spending a couple of weeks in space has changes in muscle and bone and even the heart muscle that are very similar to the aging process. And so we're very interested in studying John's adaptation to space and then his readaptation to the Earth's gravity. It was an amazing experience to get to know him well and also his family, his lovely wife Annie, and yeah, high point of my career.
Wow, awesome. Let's talk about Mount Everest. When did you first get the idea that you wanted to climb Mount Everest?
Well, yeah, I read about Mallory and Hillary as a young kid, and at around age 15 started rock climbing fairly seriously. So the seed was planted fairly early on that it would be very exciting to go climb Mount Everest. I didn't really consider it even a remote possibility until perhaps my late 20s, when I had really developed some technical skills, and at that point I decided that I would progressively work my way up in terms of technical difficulty and in altitude on mountains and see if it was in the cards for me. I didn't want to rush my way over to the Himalayas and make a mistake and end up you know, staying there for the rest of eternity, you know, right, on the mountain slope. So I think it's very important to be respectful of the mountains, in particular Everest and the Himalayas, and you know, you need to have not only the technical skills and the endurance and strength, but the judgment built over, you know, many seasons and many expeditions before you should tackle Everest.
Now, if I understand correctly, you have climbed 53 of Colorado's peaks that were over 14,000 feet.
Right, I just have one left. I was you know, planning to go from a peak called North Maroon, mm-hmm, across this ridge line to South Maroon, and to finish off what's called the Colorado Grand Slam last summer. But unfortunately, a storm came up early in the morning, and you don't want to get caught up at 14,000 feet in the Rockies with a thunder and lightning storm. So I put it off for some future date to finish that quest. But I will finish it.
Now, was that part of your preparation when you were thinking about to take on Mount Everest? You said, well, first let me tackle some of these smaller peaks, 14,000 feet.
Yeah, it sure was. You know, I've climbed several of them in the winter, which is a good analog for Himalayan mountaineering. It's not nearly the same altitude, but it's, if you're coming from sea level from Texas up to Colorado and adjusting to the altitude and working your way up those peaks, some of which can be quite challenging. It's a great training ground for bigger mountains around the world.
And when did you say to your wife, well, I want to go to Mount Everest and climb Mount Everest? And from that time, how much time did you give yourself to prepare mentally and physically for that climb?
Well, I think she kind of had full disclosure when she first met me.
Okay.
I had already been invited to climb Mount Everest in 1994 with a British Mount Everest medical expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually had been invited to go climb with them. I didn't actually get a chance to go because I had just been hired by NASA. So I put it on the back burner for, 14 years before I actually went.
So Gail knew from day one that my husband is going to climb Mount Everest one day.
More or less, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how much time, when you made the commitment to yourself, okay, I'm going to climb Mount Everest, was it 2 years of prep, 1 year of prep?
Well, I'd always, all that while I had been targeting other mountains around the world. So, you know, Mount McKinley or Denali in Alaska, Aconcagua in South America, and other peaks in the Andes. So I was always working pretty hard in the gym, either running or cycling to keep myself, you know, fit.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course developing the technical skills to work up there.
And as you prepare for your missions in space, when you prepare to climb Mount Everest, is there a team of people that you're working with?
Yes. So I traveled to Mount Everest with a group called International Mountain Guides. They're an outfitter in the Seattle, Washington area. I believe, Ashford, Washington. Mm-hmm. And they have a great track record. I didn't go with a guide. I had quite a bit of experience. My first season on the mountain, I went with a friend of mine, Adam, who had climbed on Mount McKinley with me on Denali. And my first season on the mountain, I ended up having a very serious back injury and not making it to the summit. But I sent Adam on. He was doing fine, and I had the reserves to get down with my Sherpa friend, Kami Sherpa. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Kami and I descended the mountain, and Adam and Angnamya Sherpa went up to the summit and summited. So mm-hmm. the next season, this past spring, I went up with a Sherpa friend, mm-hmm. But also under the flag of the IMG team, which really did a fantastic job.
And when you had that back injury, you had to make a decision to stop, and mm-hmm. and you really had to do some soul searching there in regards to, wow, I've prepared for this all my life, I'm here, but I'm going to have to stop. Or was it that you just said, you know, this is my time, and I'll just do it another time? What was going through your mind at the time?
Oh, it was a gut-wrenching moment, for sure. I had spent 59 days on the mountain getting my body acclimatized to summit. I was on the summit push at 24,500 feet within 24 hours of standing on top, and I had just excruciating back pain that you know, was not going away with rest and with icing it down. And so I decided, you know, maybe I could tighten my waist harness a little bit, kind of like a weight lifter's a belt, you know, and dull the pain that way, stabilize my back, and go for the top. And I did that, and it didn't ameliorate the pain, and I realized at that point that if I did force my way up a little bit higher, I could jeopardize not only my own health and safety, but that of my friends around me and my teammates, and maybe not only jeopardize their summit success, but maybe even their safety as well. So at that point, you know, I had to turn around and you know, not knowing whether or not I would get a chance to go back. It hurt.
And was it at that point that you said, okay, I'm going to not make it this time for the safety of me and, of course, of the folks that I'm climbing this mountain with, but also I want to make sure I'm there for my family, but I'm going to make a second attempt. When did you make that decision to make that second attempt?
Well, as I left you know, my high point descending the mountain, I really didn't know what was going on with my body, if I'd even be able to ever climb again. So it was kind of scary. And then, of course, it's a very committing thing to take 2 months of your life and go climb Mount Everest. It's expensive. It's disruptive to family, to your profession, and so on. And so I wasn't sure that I'd ever be able to come back. It was, you know, I'd invested so much energy into getting to that point, and then to turn around, turn my back on the summit was really gut-wrenching. But once I got back, it was established that I needed surgery to remove a disc fragment that was pressing on a nerve, and it was a relatively simple procedure. Within a couple of months, I was back in the gym and able to consider trying again. So then I joke about this, but you know, some people will tell you that the hardest part about climbing Mount Everest is just getting on the plane. It's there's so much preparation that goes into arranging your life, getting, you know, your financing, your sponsorships, your family settled while you're away. Obviously, matters of employment. There's a huge sense of relief when you actually sit down and, you know, board the plane for Kathmandu. Obviously, the physical and mental workload ahead of you is really challenging too. But I would say, just right after Christmas, a year ago is when I kind of had a sense that it was really going to happen, that I would go back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how did you prepare differently for your second attempt?
Well, I was obviously very protective of my back while on the mountain, much more so than I had been the year before. But also I did a lot more back stabilizing and core exercises before returning to the mountain. And then I also did them while I was there, even at base camp. So that seemed to be the trick.
And how many people were in your party that summited the mountain with you?
Well, my summit day, we had 12 from the IMG team. And all told, I think we had 25 climbers on the IMG.
Oh, wow.
Permit. Not all of them summited. Typically, it's about one in three people mm-hmm. will summit.
And I guess there's a leader amongst the IMG team that is actually leading the expedition up the summit?
Absolutely. Clear level-headedness is paramount. Obviously, there are dramatic things that can and do happen in these environments, and panic is never a solution. So, assuming a calm leadership and making decisions based on knowledge of the mountain and on the strengths and weaknesses of your team, you can do very well. And as we saw this past season on Everest, we were able to rescue a couple of climbers out of the avalanche on the icefall. Members of our Sherpa team, led by Eric Simonson, were able to extract a couple of climbers and get them down to safety.
Oh, boy, that is such a good feeling to see that someone's life has been saved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, saving lives, of course, which our audience doesn't know yet, you just mentioned about being an emergency room doctor, but you've also served as an emergency room doctor.
That's right. My medical training led me to pursue a career in emergency medicine and trauma, and probably I'd still be doing that had I not been selected by NASA back in 1992. I was in a residency training program when I got the call from NASA. But it certainly was a great training environment for leadership. As an emergency physician, you are responsible for the health and well-being of anyone who walks through that door. And so oftentimes you see critically ill and injured patients come in, and it's your job to, prevent them from dying and to try and assure the best outcome possible for them while all sorts of things are happening around you. And typically you're juggling several different patients and dozens of people, nursing staff and respiratory technicians and others are whispering in your ears with questions, and you have to manage all those patients and all those inputs at the same time. And it's a real juggling act for sure.
And I remember when Anthea Stratigos of Outsell, you were supposed to speak at the conference the year before, but unfortunately due to the hurricane, you had some matters there in Houston that you needed to address. And I believe that you and a number of your colleagues were really busy helping save lives and helping to administer to the people who were injured there. Can you tell us about that environment that you were in? Was it, I guess it was 24/7. You had triage that was set up in different venues. What was it like to be a leader in that situation?
Oh, that's a great question, Durella. Actually, you're actually speaking of two different hurricanes.
Okay.
The year before, it was Hurricane Ike, and that actually affected us here personally in Houston. We were without power for 12 days, and so I needed to attend to our home and our family. That prevented me from traveling out to the conference. But it was actually in the aftermath of Katrina when thousands of people came from the New Orleans area, where I was involved in the medical care of some quite sick people at the Astrodome and then in the Reliance Center surrounding it. And so I took off a couple of weeks from work, took a vacation. It wasn't much of a vacation, I assure you, but
right.
it was really an amazing time. I really felt great about Houston because the whole city really opened up its arms to people who really needed a lot of help. And so, you know, very proud of the city and the way it it behaved as a whole to help people in need.
Wow, just amazing, just amazing. And getting back to Mount Everest, when you finally summited Mount Everest, what was the feeling that you had?
Well, it was just a feeling of incredible euphoria. I think perhaps because of delayed gratification, if you will, it had evaded me or eluded me the year before. It had been an incredible struggle to get back up to a point where I could tackle the summit again and to actually make it. Certainly the hardest thing I'd ever done physically as well as mentally. It was spectacular. One of my goals had been to arrive there at sunrise so that I could see a sunrise from the top of the mountain, and I arrived 5 minutes before the orange glow began, and I was able to see the entire sunrise as I descended the summit ridge. So it was a dream come true to be up there.
Wow, just awesome, just awesome. And from what I understand, I received your email in regards to the program has already aired on the Discovery Channel.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to air it in the near future?
It is available now online.
Oh,
so if
okay.
you go to discovery.com / videos, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and search for Everest or Everest Beyond the Limit, you can see all of the episodes there, including mine, which was the third episode. I think the title of it is Deadly Countdown. You have to have a dramatic a title for these things, but it was a very well done. My only disappointment was that they didn't spend nearly enough time talking about the Sherpas that were part of our team. But that's Hollywood for you, I guess. But
that's right. That's right. Well, maybe when you have a chance to do it again, you can produce your own segment and do it from your point of view.
Well, I don't know that I'll have a chance to go back, at least not while still married.
Well, I guess Gail has said twice is more than enough.
So yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's great. And tell us about Gail. I had the opportunity of having dinner with you and Gail at the Outsell meeting, and she just seems like the most down-to-earth person that you can ever meet. And just a dynamic lady. And tell us a little bit about Gail and your two children.
Oh, yeah. She's very patient with me, first and foremost, but also just a very kind-hearted, really funny person. She's got a great sarcastic sense of humor. Works in a very high-stress job, actually. She's a director of the emergency room, emergency department at the Texas Children's Hospital.
Oh, wow.
She's a nurse by training, but now oversees the nursing and house staff of the department, and so it's a very dynamic environment as well. But she's very calm under pressure, and that certainly helps her balance all the dynamic things in our lives. And then we have two kids. My son Luke is just turning 13 as of tomorrow, and then my daughter Jenna is 10.
Okay. And what does Luke like to do with his time after school?
Well, he loves basketball. In fact, I'm on my way to a basketball game here in just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he loves the sport and then also likes the outdoors quite a bit. So looking forward to sharing the mountains with him in the future.
Excellent, excellent. And tell us a little bit about your daughter.
My daughter Jenna is a beautiful little girl. She is autistic. So that has been obviously a significant challenge mm-hmm. as parents, but we've investigated a great deal about the disorder and provided her with a lot of additional resources that have really made a big difference in her life, and she's doing extremely well in school, and we're very hopeful that she continues to do well and to learn and to adapt with the autism that you know, is a struggle for her, no doubt.
Oh, no doubt. And that is something that many of our families in the United States are faced with. And she is so blessed to have you and Gail as her parents to help her with that.
Yeah, it's I feel for any parent that has a special needs child. You do everything that you possibly can for them, of course, and but it does, you know, we've seen that it's made a huge difference to give her the extra attention that she needs, and we're thrilled that autism is getting more and more public awareness. Of course, it's now 1 in 150 children born in this country will be diagnosed with it. So we need to apply a lot of energy and research dollars to get to the bottom of it and prevent it and or find better treatments for it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what we'll be sure to do, we'll be sure to post the autism site up on our website so that folks can get more information. I think the more that we speak about it, the more that we educate people, and the more research we can do it, we can certainly work towards understanding it better and to help folks with it, that's for sure.
Thank you, Durrell. Yeah, if you could post Autism Speaks, it's a great organization that I've recently become involved with a little bit. That would be great.
We certainly would do that, and I'll make sure when it's up, I'll send you the link, and you can share it with all of your friends and colleagues.
Will do.
And, you know, you spoke earlier about John Glenn as one of your boyhood heroes, but who are some of your most recent heroes that you like to share with our audience?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I guess my just dating back to my childhood, Glenn certainly was one, Jacques Cousteau, Neil Armstrong, Edmund Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more recently, I guess I would count among them my daughter, which mm-hmm. may sound a little bit unusual, but just the way that she has you know, faces the world, but you know, is still you know, such a happy, engaging kid, and tries so hard, even though she struggles with you know, expressive and receptive language, which is one of the hallmarks of autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's really a wonderful kid, and also my son, just the way he's so empathetic with her, and obviously become a role model for her. It's really a beautiful thing to see them, you know, playing together and growing together.
Absolutely, absolutely. And is there a particular quote that you like to share with the audience that that really identifies leadership as you see it through your eyes?
There's a fun one that I can share with you. It's from a climbing friend of mine. He's actually a NASA engineer. I summited Aconcagua in South America with him. It's the tallest mountain in the world outside of Asia, and got to know him very well. And his quote for the trip, which I think bears quite heavily on leadership, is no true adventure is fun while it's happening. And what that means to me is, you know, there are certain things that, you know, take a great deal of patience and tenacity and hard work, business leadership decisions, you know, starting, whether to start a new company, whether to invest, divest, hire, fire, these things can be gut-wrenching decisions for business leaders, but in the outcome, when you look back on them, oftentimes is wonderful. So we would often remark that you know no true adventure is fun while it's happening. You know, in other words, you know, slogging our way up this peak is pretty miserable. But it's amazing right now when I think back on that trip, I can only remember the positive things out of it. You know, the team that I was with, the views from the top, and everything in between. So,
you know, that reminds me of my late stepfather, who said to me when I was going through a particularly challenging time, he says, "Well, when you're climbing the mountain of life, it's the rough spots that give you something to hold on to."
Exactly. There it is. Yeah.
So, And that stayed with me, and that made me really realize that maybe my problems weren't so bad. And I got through it just fine. And last but not least, what is your favorite book on leadership?
Well, there are several. I'm not sure I can point to one, but as I think I mentioned earlier, I've always really admired General Powell. My American Journey is a really wonderful book. There are all sorts of mountaineering books that I really enjoy. The Ascent of Everest by John Hunt, that talked about the 1953 first successful summit of Mount Everest, where they really had to approach the mountain in kind of a military, you know, siege tactic, and all the logistics that went into it. It's not written in the